Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
The next target for organizing in America. Target. First contract ratified at BuzzFeed News. And today on the show, it's the latest from the Connecticut AFL-CIO and the Indiana Graduate Workers Union. Welcome to the Monday, May 16th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. Once again, I want to call attention to our revamped website. If you miss a show, just go to awfpodcast.com, awfpodcast.com. awfradio.com still works, but we're trying to drive everything to awfpodcast.com. Lots of good information on there. Ways you can connect with America's workforce. Suggest a guest. We always look for new guests on the show, so do check that out, awfpodcast.com. Ed Hawthorne is going to be our first guest on the show today. He is the president of the Connecticut State Labor Federation, the AFL-CIO, and he hasn't been there very long. He was elected to that position on a unanimous vote last October, the end of October. Ed is a member and vice president of AFSCME Local 269, worked as a hearing officer for the Connecticut Department of Labor, and previously served as president of the Western Connecticut Area Labor Federation. He was also a member of the Connecticut AFL-CIO Executive Board prior to him becoming president. Well, I'll tell you, Connecticut is one state that is helping workers in so many ways. We're going to talk about this on the show today. Number one, captive audience legislation. Listen to this. On Friday of April 29th, just a couple of weeks ago, the Connecticut House of Representatives gave final approval to a bill that would protect workers seeking to form a union from captive audience meetings. How about that? They are now the second state in the country. Oregon was the first. And this is all about allowing workers to leave a captive audience meeting. And that meeting could be about politics, religion, mainly union organizing, without fear of discipline or termination. So you can walk out and everything is going to be okay. You know what's going on in America right now. There's a lot of organizing going on, and there's a lot of captive audience meetings going on. Amazon, Starbucks, I'll get to Target in a minute. But it's happening, and workers are being threatened. If you join a union, you're going to lose your job. You're going to pay a whole lot of dues. It's going to change the whole complexion of the company. You don't want to do that. And they keep pounding that message in. And you know why they do it? Because it works. It works. You talk to any organizer out there, and they will tell you, well, we think we're going to get a union at XYZ company. And then when the vote happens, forget it. They shoot down the union, sometimes by a ridiculous margin. Why? Because the workers are being intimidated. Well, that's changing in the state of Connecticut. Pandemic pay for essential workers. The state federation has advocated for pandemic pay for all essential workers, and they're getting it. $30 million going to be spread around in Connecticut. That's just the tip of the iceberg. So Ed Hawthorne, who heads the State Labor Federation in Connecticut, will be our first guest. Later in the show, we're going to check in with Cole Nelson. Now, Cole is a first-year PhD student in the media school at Indiana University. He is a union rep for the Indiana Graduate Workers Coalition, where he has been fighting for union recognition alongside 1,800 other graduate workers at Indiana University. That's right, 1,800 plus. They are supported by 600 plus faculty members, 1,000 undergrads, 1,200 alumni. Their agenda for change: a living wage with annual raises, protect and improve benefits, an effective grievance procedure, fairness for international students. Well, because they have not been getting their way, they went on strike. And it was like a 90 to 95% vote to authorize a strike. And it's been going on for several weeks. We'll check to see the status on that later in the show. They are affiliated, this Graduate Workers Coalition is affiliated with the United Electrical Workers. Yeah, and I got the vote here. The vote was 867 to 39. And that was to extend their strike, which was going on for 2 weeks for another week. Yeah, there's some solidarity there, don't you think? So we'll talk about organizing. That is a right-to-work state, by the way. And we'll talk about the support that they're getting from the community. So Cole Nelson will be joining us later in the show. Now on to the story about Target joining a wave of retail organizing. Workers at a Target store in Virginia have filed for a union election with the National Labor Relations Board. Workers at the store, which is in Christiansburg, Virginia, say they are overstretched and not seeing their pay keep up with inflation. This is according to Adam Ryan, who heads the Target Workers United Group. And like many companies, Target workers are being subjected to anti-union propaganda from the company, which was leaked earlier this year that they were going to start this campaign. The training specifically stated that unions could lead to, quote, reduced flexibility and narrowed job descriptions. That's what's happening at Target. Meanwhile, an anti-union memo from Apple was released over the weekend. That memo, obtained and verified by Vice's Motherboard magazine, was sent to Apple store leaders and contains talking points to combat unionization at Apple retail stores. The talking points suggest to workers that forming a union could lead to a loss of flexibility in granting time off, job promotions based on merit, and career experiences. There's a lot of things to consider. One of the memo headings reads, one is how a union could fundamentally change the way we work. And under the heading, the memo emphasizes that a union, quote, would actually speak for you on most cases related to work, going on to remind workers that they may disagree with the union's approach to something. Now, the memo does not also remind workers that even if a majority of workers or elected union leadership make decisions that are different from what some or many individual workers desire, as necessarily happens in a democracy, having a union gives workers more of a voice rather than less to countervail the currently unilateral power of Apple to determine wages, working conditions, and all rules governing work for employees. The memo also notes that a future union contract could lead to more rigid rules that impede flexibility. The memo comes after workers at three Apple stores filed for union election with the labor board. One of these is the Cumberland Mall store in Atlanta, which is scheduled to vote starting June 2nd, and it would be the first Apple store to unionize if successful. Eli Daniel is a store employee and an organizer, and he said, "We want to have a voice in our workplace. Their demands include fair compensation, career development, equity, health and well-being, and safety." Also, Apple's Grand Central Terminal retail store, this is in Manhattan, has also filed for a vote where the organizers, calling themselves Fruit Stand Workers United, obviously in affiliation to Apple, they are connected to SEIU's Workers United. And a third drive is taking place at a store in Maryland. And we got some good news out of the BuzzFeed News Union. They have voted unanimously to ratify their first union contract with the company. This past March, over 91% of the unit voted in favor of a strike amidst announcement of proposed cuts at the company. Through the bargaining process, members engage in collective, concerted, and escalating actions to move management toward a more just and serious bargaining process, including a one-day walkout that happened in December. In a statement, quote, the BuzzFeed News Union has been fighting for our first contract for more than 2 years, and we are so proud to say that today we voted unanimously to ratify our first collective bargaining agreement. The statement goes on, despite consistent resistance from management, a side quest to negotiate a work-sharing agreement, we never backed down. Several members of the union's bargaining committee started at BuzzFeed, making less than $40,000 a year. The new contract sets a salary floor for union jobs at $60,000, and that's going to increase 2.5% every year. That is a pretty good jump. So congratulations to the BuzzFeed News Union. Yeah, there's a lot of organizing going on in the digital platforms that media is moving to, and we've talked about that with the News Guild over the years here on America's Workforce. Certainly good news. Everything pointing in the right direction. We like that. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to connect with Ed Hawthorne, president of the Connecticut Labor Federation.
This is America's Workforce.
It takes LIUNA to build North America's infrastructure. From roads and bridges to schools and skyscrapers, the men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, build the projects we depend on. From constructing the Freedom Tower on the site of the former World Trade Center to untangling Washington, D.C.'s congested interstate, LIUNA members do the work that matters. Find out what it takes to be built by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
We're the nurses, firefighters, and claims representatives that help keep our government services running. We respond to natural disasters. We care for our nation's veterans, and we investigate discrimination in the workplace. We are federal and D.C. government workers, and we are proud to serve the American people. Working in more than 70 agencies across the government, we know we can fulfill our mission because our union has our back. Learn more at AFGE.org. Paid for by the American Federation of Government Employees, AFL-CIO.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
The AFL-CIO is a proud sponsor of America's Workforce Radio. United by efforts to raise wages, listeners to this show and workers all across America are beginning to turn a corner and drive the economic debate. The AFL-CIO is comprised of 12.5 million working people from 56 unions, but we stand with and fight for everyone who is working for a better life. For more information about our raising wages agenda, go to AFLCIO.org.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. By the way, this next segment brought to you in part by the North Coast Labor Federation, all connected to the AFL-CIO. And I got to give a plug to the national website on what's going on in America with inflation, why costs are going up, and how to fix it. They are asking you to take a survey. What matters to you? Go to AFLCIO.org/member survey, and you could chime in. And there's a lot of good information posted there on why things are going up, you know, the supply chain, all the jobs that went overseas. We can't get the products over here now. Corporate greed is a big one. There's a figure out there that over the course of the pandemic, billionaires, their wages went up, and this is a lot to do with the stock market, $2 trillion. Yeah, $2 trillion. That's how much it went up. And the infrastructure's in there. If we improve our infrastructure, obviously that will help the supply chain. So do check it out, AFLCIO.org/member survey. All right, let's go to the state of Connecticut right now, and joining us on line number one is Ed Hawthorne. I told my producer, hey, you know what? We got to talk to the head guy over at the Labor Federation in Connecticut because they are doing all the right things for workers. And we have that gentleman on our show today. His name is Ed Hawthorne, and he comes to us from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. He was the vice president of Local 269 there for a number of years. He was a hearing officer for the Connecticut Department of Labor. Ed Hawthorne, thanks for joining us here on America's Workforce. How are we doing today, my brother?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me. Thank you for all the kind words.
So, well, you deserve it. I mean, you're doing all the right things over there. I wish you could bring some of that to the state of Ohio, you know? There's
a
lot
team
of
effort.
Hey, Ed, talk to me about yourself. I obviously you have a background at AFSCME. How did you get involved in union life?
So I've kind of always been involved in union life. I grew up in a union household, and I ended up going to college at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, played football there, decided I wanted to go on to law school, went to law school in Buffalo, had a great time there for 3 years, came back home to Connecticut. It was in 2009 when I graduated. The economy wasn't great. I ended up getting a job at the courthouse and then on to the Department of Labor, where I did unemployment compensation appeals hearings for 10 years. And that's really where I got involved in my local there, you know, fighting to make sure we had the correct working conditions, the employer followed the contract. And from there, I ended up becoming president of my local labor council chapter for the AFL-CIO, and then president of the Western Connecticut Area Labor Federation, where we ran the municipal political outreach for the AFL-CIO for the western half of Connecticut. On from there, as you said, I was unanimously elected this October by my brothers and sisters, and I became the actually the youngest person to ever hold this role at 36 years old.
Well, congratulations to you. That's cool. Got a lot of energy, and obviously, I often say this on the show, you're moving the needle in the right direction. Now, you have, is it all like Democrat, House, Senate, Governor over there in the state of Connecticut?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Has it been like that for quite some time?
It has been, and I believe a few years ago we had a split Senate, which was a little bit hard to work with, but since then we've recovered. You know, we have a good political program here that we run at the Connecticut AFL-CIO, and we really do get out there. And you know, I always say to my people, I say, well, we're never going to outspend people, but we're always going to outwork them, and solidarity beats money any day of the week.
There you go. Well, there's a lot of issues I want to get into, and congratulations on getting a pandemic pay for so many people over there in the state of Connecticut. But the big story, and everybody's talking about this, Ed, as you know, captive audience meetings. In fact, we spent some time. We have a super lady here that deals with NLRB legislation, and that would be Joyce Goldstein. We had her on the show on Friday talking about these captive audience meetings and how the labor board, specifically Jennifer Abruzzo, the general counsel there, has deemed them illegal. And this is huge. I mean, this is the first time something like this has been said by someone in the NLRB in years, and they need the full vote of the board. So with that being said, you've got individual states that can also make their own actions, and that's exactly what happened in your legislature. So talk to me about the campaign on captive audience legislation in the state of Connecticut. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the captive audience bill was a priority for our state federation because it affects each and every one of our affiliates. I mean, you need to organize in order to survive. So we made that our priority. And what we started out by doing was we started out by just telling a story. So we got people together that have been through these meetings and organizers that can talk to it. And we had 9 videos professionally filmed and ready to go. And we rolled them out weekly. So when we had those conversations with our General Assembly, and the first question was always, does this really happen? We were able to send them the videos and kind of cut through it. And as you probably know, you've probably talked to these people before, heard their stories. They're emotional. And the fear that they go through in these meetings about, you know, possibly losing their job just to stick up for, you know, their right to join a union, it really cut through a lot of it. We had an op-ed campaign where we had multiple op-eds. I was able to be on our Sunday morning television shows in the state of Connecticut for both NBC and Fox to kind of fight back on some of the misinformation. The employer lobby was calling it a gag order. Our bill is not a gag order. It just allows somebody that disagrees with speech regarding politics, union organizing, or religion to respectfully get up and leave the room. The employer can talk about whatever they want. They can tell you, you know, the sky is purple. They can bring in a political candidate to try to tell you to vote for that candidate. But it's not preventing speech. It's preventing coerced speech, which forces people to stay there. And that's why I think our bill is, you know, both constitutional and not preempted, just as our attorney general has stated. And I can't say enough about our attorney general and the way that Attorney General William Tong came forward with his opinion, came to our press conferences, you know, really stuck up for this and really cut through a lot of the misinformation that was out there about the bill.
Now, in the course of this passage here, and by the way, did the governor sign this legislation yet?
We're still planning. We're actually planning a bill signing with the governor. So,
okay.
Yes,
okay.
Quite signed yet, but we want to have a little celebration when he does sign it.
Well, you should have. You break out the champagne for that one, no doubt about it. In the course of the debate on this, Ed, did a lot of workers come forward and talk about the intimidation, the threats that went on in those captive audience meetings?
Oh, absolutely. And we shared that a lot with the videos as well. I mean, two examples that come to mind, we had a nurse that was involved in an organizing campaign in a hospital that was forced into a hospital supply closet by a manager and threatened to stop their support for a union. In a major hotel chain in Stamford, Connecticut, an immigrant female housekeeper whose first language was not English was alone in a hotel room at night just doing her job. She was then approached by three white men who immediately closed the door behind them, started raising their voice to her in an attempt to dissuade her from her support for forming a union in her workplace. I mean, these are the kind of stories that we need to get out there in order to have support for these bills, because there's a human factor behind it. The employer wants to treat you like a number, whereas we want to show that there is an effect and a fear and a chilling effect that this has on people. And we actually had, believe it or not, we had bipartisan support. We had two senators vote for this and one representative vote for this that came from the Republican side of the aisle, because they heard these stories and they heard the workers and they said, you know, this just isn't right and employers shouldn't treat their employees this way. And they actually framed it that it was, you know, in order for an employee to be productive, they shouldn't be hauled into these meetings for hours at a time and threatened and harassed.
I see on your website you have some of these videos posted. By the way, those of you listening right now, the website for the Connecticut Labor Federation is ctaflcio.org, ctaflcio.org. I see the one there with the nurse. She was actually forced into a closet? That really happened then, huh?
Yes, absolutely. And this is the kind of – people don't believe it until you hear it out of – person's mouth. And that's why the videos, I think, were so effective in this campaign, because you can, when you watch the videos, you can feel their fear, because they're telling a story of something that was, I mean, there's no other way to put it. It was trauma.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Ed, you're telling me off the air that Oregon passed this captive audience legislation about a decade ago. Is this legislation in Connecticut kind of modeled after that one? Did you take a look at that one and kind of formulate yours in Connecticut that way?
I mean, it's modeled in a way. Ours, I believe, isn't a ban on speech, but a ban on coerced speech. Ours is more of a free speech issue, whereas the Supreme Court has ruled that you cannot force someone to listen to speech they disagree with. And that's exactly what our bill does. That's why we believe that in no way is it preempted by federal law, and we're so happy that the LRB is looking to ban them outright. But as we know, you know, sometimes presidents change and sometimes the board changes. That's why it's so important to have your own state law to protect your workers within your state.
Now, has any other states come to you after seeing, I'm sure they've seen the videos on your website, and they're probably thinking, well, maybe we should do that in this state. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of states that are not going to do it. Mississippi, the right to work states, you're not going to see that happen. But the states that have not gone in that direction, have they called on you?
I haven't heard from any states yet, but that's why we're on the podcast today. Get in contact with us. We'd be happy to have a conversation with you and help you along with your campaign and do anything we need to protect workers, not only here in Connecticut, but nationwide.
That's awesome. Okay, let's switch over to pandemic pay for essential workers. And I remember when the pandemic broke out, there was heroes pay, and it was very short-lived. So maybe you could pick it up from there. How does this one pan out?
So we made pandemic pay or pandemic hazard pay or heroes pay, whatever you want to call it. We made it a priority of ours because we kept saying that we can't forget the fear that people had at the beginning of the pandemic. And, you know, COVID-19 has shown more than ever how vital working people are to keep every family safe, secure, healthy, and fed. Essential workers in Connecticut and nationwide put their lives on the line to fight an invisible virus and save the lives of others and really keep society propped up while the rest of us were staying home, staying safe, watching Tiger King on Netflix and things like that. I mean, these people, I mean, we had people in Connecticut that worked in, you know, prisons and in hospitals that were staying in college dorms because they were afraid to go home to their family. So we said to the governor and to the General Assembly that they needed to make this a priority. I mean, we didn't get everything we wanted. At first, we started out with an ask of $750 million to give $2,000 to every full-time worker that was essential and $1,000 to every part-time worker. We ended up getting $30 million to provide pandemic hazard pay to only private sector workers in CDC vaccination schedule categories 1A, 1B. Full-time workers earning less than $100,000 will receive $1,000. Part-time will receive $500. The level decreases as your earnings increase, and it's, I believe, at $150,000, you're down to nothing at that point. It protects, you know, workers from employer retaliation for applying, and it is on a first-come, first-served basis. We have to thank the Speaker of the House here in Connecticut, Matt Ritter, for his efforts to secure this for essential workers. He's really the one that heard the call and made sure that it was included in the budget itself. We're disappointed that municipal workers have been left out, but, you know, state employees are negotiating their own hazard pay, and we're extremely encouraged that they will receive something as well.
Now, obviously, you must have a chunk of dough in your budget, especially since you're asking for $750 million on this. What's making Connecticut so successful over there in the state budget?
For once, Connecticut has a lot of money. Connecticut has a projected nearly $4 billion budget surplus and $3.1 billion in our rainy day fund, which is our savings account. I mean, we're talking about using a fraction of that, is what I was saying, for essential workers. So it's really not a question about affordability. It's a question about priorities. And do we want to prioritize the sacrifice that these workers make, or, you know, do we want to do something else with the money? I think you put money into people's pockets that propped up society, and that's the argument we consistently made.
How did you fare in the pandemic over there? I mean, I know a lot of these frontline workers died, nurses. You think about those who were the bus drivers, subway drivers, doctors. I mean, a lot of them got sick during the pandemic. What was your protocol over there?
I mean, we were one of the hardest hit states at first because, you know, we share a border with New York City, and a lot of people commute in and out. So we were one of the first states to be hit really hard with the pandemic. We did have great leadership for our governor that listened to science and listened to doctors. I remember at one point, and I'm paraphrasing here, but somebody asked the governor if he was going to follow some guidance. And the governor just said, listen, I'm not a doctor. You should, or actually it was about something, but it was, the question was alluding to not listening to a doctor. And the governor said, I'm not a doctor. You should listen to your doctor. And I wish more governors actually had that mindset during the pandemic. It was like, I don't know everything about, you know, epidemiology or, you know, how this virus is transmitted, that I should really just take a step back, listen to the folks that do know what they're talking about and follow it. And although Connecticut was hit hard, I think we would have had a much worse outcome had we had a governor that was not willing to listen to the science.
Yeah. And how are you doing today we're still in the middle of the pandemic. What's the situation there now?
Our rates are still high. Luckily, the hospitalizations and deaths are not what they were. I mean, I worked very closely with workers at my hometown hospital, Waterbury Hospital in Connecticut, and the stories I heard from these workers in the middle of the pandemic were horrifying. I had one worker that was a technician at the beginning of the pandemic say she was advised by her manager that she was not permitted to change her mask until it was, and I quote, visibly soiled. I had another nurse that said, we're no longer providing care. We're hanging on by our fingernails and just hoping that people don't die because they were so overwhelmed. I hope we never get back to that point again. But stuff like that really does chill you to a core. It has an effect on you. And I tried to get that out there as much as possible. And that's why pandemic hazard pay was so important and personal to me.
Getting back to the pay itself now, this is a done deal. They're about to get the money. What's the status right now, Ed?
So it is in the budget. The budget was signed. So it is there. It's passed. We just need to government needs to develop a mechanism in order to actually get that out. It's going to be administered by the state comptroller. So we do have essential workers hazard pay fund already, which has about the same amount of money in there. It's about $35 million. And that was anyone that got sick or unfortunately passed away during the pandemic, and if they got sick and they lost money by way of, you know, had to be out sick, had to quarantine, whatever it was, medical bills, they were able to apply to that fund and get the money from that fund, or burial benefits were capped, but they were in there as well. So I imagine it's going to mirror that fund because that was on a first-come, first-served basis as well.
Very good. All right, we're speaking with Ed Hawthorne, who is the president of the Connecticut State Labor Federation. CTAFLCIO.org is their website. They also have a presence on Facebook. You got to go to the homepage there and check those videos out on the captive audience meetings. Those are priceless. Later in the show, we're going to be joined with Cole Nelson. Cole heads the Indiana Graduate Workers Union, and they are striking, and he's going to tell us why. Back in a few minutes.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
It takes LIUNA to power North America with affordable energy. The men and women of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, have the skills needed to build and maintain oil, natural gas, nuclear, solar, and wind projects that are shaping America's energy future. From new energy tech to retrofitted facilities, LIUNA members do it all. Find out what it takes to be powered by LIUNA at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
American workers are the best in the world, but we face an uphill battle against countries like China that don't play by the rules. There's a bill right now in Congress that would give American workers the trade tools we need to fight back and win. Join me in telling Congress to pass this bill. Visit AmericanManufacturing.org to learn how.
Paid for by the Alliance for American Manufacturing.
Union members need to be heard. Reliable and convenient union voting has never been more important than it is now. Make voting easy for your membership by working with survey and ballot systems. SBS offers encrypted and monitored solutions that ensure your elections are accurate and accessible for every member through mail-in, online, and in-person voting. Visit surveyandballotsystems.com and take the next step in getting secure and auditable elections.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And remember, you can check us out on at least six platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Pandora, and Stitcher. When you get an opportunity, just sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and give us a rating. We always appreciate those five-star ratings. So please keep them coming. Let's go back to Connecticut. Joining us on our live line today is Ed Hawthorne, who is president of the Connecticut State Labor Federation. Again, the website, ctaflcio.org. And their Twitter handle, by the way, is CONNAFLCIO. You can follow them there. So, captive audience legislation, governor's about to sign it, pandemic pay almost across the finish line, all the right things happening for workers in the state of Connecticut. But there's always more. I'm looking at wage theft, which is a huge issue in America, and air quality in schools. Let's talk about that. Apparently, this is something I know the sheet metal workers have been concentrating on because they're involved with the HVAC system. So what's going on there, Ed?
Indoor air quality, you know, was, when you look at it in the full context, I think it was a win. We have $150 million for school HVAC upgrades over the next 2 years. That's a large sum of money, and it's really needed. I mean, the bill also that we passed calls for an in-depth HVAC system assessment for all schools. Every school in the state of Connecticut must be completed by certified technicians, good union technicians, by 2024 and every 5 years afterwards, including identifying needs for corrective actions. It requires more frequent tools for school monitoring every 3 years instead of five, and it establishes a working group to identify safe indoor humidity and temperature ranges, emergency school closure criteria, protocols used by schools to receive, investigate, and address complaints or evidence of mold, pest infestation, you know, hazardous odors or chemicals. I do call it a win, but we really wanted it to go further. What we did push for was a temperature standard. And what I told the General Assembly when I testified, and anyone that would listen to me, is that we have a temperature standard for dog kennels in Connecticut, but not for our schools. The teachers are asking to be treated like dogs, and you all are saying no. So that's where the working group came from, and we hope to get there, and we're going to continue pushing until, you know, there is a safe temperature standard in schools and the indoor air quality standard in schools. If the pandemic has taught us nothing, it's that we can't ignore indoor air quality.
No, not at all. Now, I have to ask you, when it comes up for debate on these issues, I mean, what did they say? Oh, we don't want good air quality, or what is it, we can't afford it, or a combination of the two?
It's always the price. When they talk about it, it appears as though everything's fine. But when they get in that back room and they start, putting out priorities for money, somehow, you know, this stuff kind of always falls to the back of the line.
It's
our job to make sure that it gets pushed back to the front, and working in partnership with our affiliates as well as some of our non-affiliates, like the Connecticut Education Association. We really worked hard on this and worked together on it to make sure that, you know, it was passed and it was something that we can move forward with and build upon.
You know, the conditions in some of the schools in America, as you well know, Ed, are atrocious. I remember doing a story a couple of years back, and it was in Detroit, and they had no heat in the schools. The kids were coming to school with their coats on. It was like 35, 40 degrees in the classrooms. And I mean, they were being ignored. They're being ignored. And that's not an isolated case. There's stories like that all around America. And you think about the air that we breathe, my God, especially now with the pandemic. And I know a lot of companies have upgraded their filtration systems, their air quality systems, but we need to keep pushing that further. It's so important. We're talking about the next generation here. It's our kids. Come on. I have to ask you, you said you got a lot of money in your budget, which leads me to think, are the conservatives saying, well, let's give that money back in the form of tax cuts? Is that happening in your state?
It is. The conservatives are going about it a different way, and they're saying that, you know, they should cut the sales tax, which, as we know, is very regressive. So we went with a more progressive method. In Connecticut, we expanded the earned income tax credit from 30% to, I think, 41.5%. We also have a child tax credit, which is, available to children with little ones like myself. And, we cut taxes, we cut our property tax and things such as that, but we have what's called a volatility cap in Connecticut. So a lot of our income comes from quarterly tax reporting because we border New York City. So our Gold Coast, that they call it, in Fairfield County, a lot of them work as stockbrokers. So it's, very volatile as it comes in. So we have the volatility cap. The good part about it is, it can go both ways. Right now, it's not only raining, it's pouring. As you said, the pandemic's still out there. We wanted them to spend everything, get people back to work, help with mental health, things such as that. They were unable to do that because of their agreed-upon volatility cap. But I believe we have $3.5 billion that's going to be deposited into our state employee and teacher pension funds, which is severely underfunded, was underfunded for years. So I guess the silver lining is, although we couldn't get the money spent to where it needs to be spent now, it's at least being spent on pensions.
That's a good thing to hear. No doubt about that. Wage theft. One more issue here before you go. How bad is it over there?
Wage theft is bad everywhere. You know, an employer's got to cut corners to cut their cost in every contract that they have. And, you know, we were able to, there was a loophole that they were using that debarment proceedings would not begin unless a complaint of wage theft was adjudicated by the Department of Labor. So what they would do is they would settle it before it was adjudicated as to not, you know, get like a point off their license, so to speak. So we were able to make it so that, you know, if it's brought up, that's something that's considered as well. So I mean, we're always going to build on it because wage theft is such a huge issue. But we do believe that this will, you know, really weed out those bad apples that kind of incorporate that savings of wage theft into their bids, which make them be lower than everybody else.
Ed, we're just about out of time here. I want to thank you for joining us on the show. Like I said before, a lot of good things happening in Connecticut, and it sounds like they got the right guy driving the bus over there. Ed Hawthorne, president of the Connecticut Labor Federation, CTAFLCIO.org. Do go to that homepage. Check out the videos. Altogether, they put together 9 videos dealing with captive audience legislation. And just a couple of weeks ago, the House of Representatives gave final approval to a bill that would protect workers seeking to form a union. And there's a lot of that going on right now. And we know what those meetings do to workers. They change their mind. Oftentimes, the organizers say, hey, I think we're going to pass it. We're going to pass it. Then the captive audience meeting comes, and they decide not to because of those threats. Well, the workers can now walk away without being terminated. Good stuff happening in the state of Connecticut. Ed, you take care. Thank you so much. And please stay in touch with all the good things happening there, okay?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. You can also check them out on Facebook and Twitter. Quick break. When we come back, Cole Nelson on behalf of the Indiana Graduate Workers Union.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
It takes LIUNA to keep America running. Over 70,000 public employees are part of LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, delivering critical services such as health care and emergency response, as well as maintaining roads and sanitation systems. Even the National Postal Mail Handlers Union, representing over 47,000 U.S. postal workers, is affiliated with LIUNA. Find out what it takes for LIUNA to keep America running at LIUNA.org. That's LIUNA.org.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
America's Workforce is sponsored in part by Boyd Watterson Asset Management, LLC. Find out more about our investment solutions tailored to meet the needs of Taft-Hartley funds at BoydWatterson.com.
From the Golden Gate Bridge to the St. Louis Gateway Arch, the Sears Tower, and just about every building, bridge, and structure in between, our cities and towns wouldn't be the same without ironworkers. With over 3,000 contractors employing more than 130,000 highly trained ironworkers and 20,000 apprentices, the Ironworkers Union stands ready and able to shape the future of our skylines. Learn more at ironworkers.org. Ironworkers, the sky's the limit.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
And don't forget, you can check us out on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Twitter handle, AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to Bloomington, Indiana right now. Joining us on line number 2 is Mr. Cole Nelson. Cole is a first-year PhD student at the Media School at Indiana University. But more importantly, he's a union rep for the Indiana Graduate Workers Coalition, where he's fighting for union recognition along 1,800 other graduate workers at Indiana University. Cole Nelson, welcome to America's Workforce. How are we doing today?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Okay, it's my pleasure. Now, are you guys on strike now or what? I saw the authorization. By the way, This union is affiliated with the United Electrical Workers Union. So what's the status on the strike right now, Cole?
So we're currently on hiatus with our strike. We conducted a four-week strike at the end of our spring semester here in Bloomington, and had voted collectively to end the strike in order to regroup, reassess, and come back at the university in fall with a stronger, more expanded strike.
Well, you've got a lot of people that are supporting you, including 600-plus faculty members, over 1,000 undergrads, alumni. What are the issues here? And I've been hearing this. Grad students are taken advantage of. I get that. Then the university comes back saying, oh, well, we're giving you a pretty good deal because, obviously, it's college is not not affordable today. I understand that. I get that part. But what are some of the issues that are driving this?
Yeah, well, we've got countless material issues, financial issues as well. Are here in the city of Bloomington, the stipends that graduate workers receive on average fall something like $15,000 below the estimated cost of living. So we're pretty firmly entrenched in a line of poverty here. So that's one of our primary issues. On top of that, the university is requiring that graduate workers pay an additional over $700 in fees if you're a domestic student, and $1,000 in fees every semester if you're an international student. So not only are our stipends meager, but we have to take a significant portion of that stipend and reroute it back to the university every passing semester, which just further depresses our take-home salary.
So you get paid, but you don't get paid enough, and it's not enough to pay for the education that you're getting. So, Cole, what is the normal cost for that? How much would that normally be? If I went over there and I wanted to get a PhD at Indiana University, what would it cost me?
So this is the little devil with the deal with the devil, the other way around, that you have to make coming to Indiana University. And this is not an exceptional situation where you can come to the university, and if you're in the College of Arts and Sciences, you can get a near free ride, with exception to the fees, for in return providing the university with your labor. So you become what they consider a part-time worker, teaching courses, grading assignments, what have you. The workload ultimately amounts to something closer to full-time work. The time you spend on the job, prepping classes, grading assignments, speaking and consulting and advising undergraduate students, ends up being well beyond a part-time job. But, of course, the university doesn't want to recognize that. Mm-hmm. If you do not make that little deal with the devil and decide to pay out of pocket here at IU, a PhD, depending on how long you are taken to complete your PhD, which certainly has a range of something like 4 years to, I've seen, 10, 11 years for certain students. You're talking dozens and dozens of thousands of dollars. Per year, it's roughly, if I'm not mistaken, $30,000 enrollment here at IU.
And that's what they're hanging over your head then. They're figuring, oh, we're giving you $30,000 worth of education, but you got to work your butts off for that. And you're probably, if you had it, add it all up, you probably would be making maybe $50,000 or $60,000 with all the work that you're doing, because that's significant work. I'm reading too that the university president got a nice little bump in pay, right?
Oh, very much so. Well, there's been major scandals around that, where we have a new president who was appointed by decree. It was not a Democratic election. And the search committee designed for this president did not ultimately appoint this president. So we've got some scandals. During this whole process of the search committee, there was a deal made with the former IU president where for his 6 months process of consultation, they were willing to give him nearly $600,000, in return. And he ultimately didn't have to consult for those 6 months. So he had a take home pay of, nearly $600,000 for doing just about nothing except retiring. So you see money circulating at IU in quite nefarious ways.
Yeah, yeah, there's money there. There's no doubt about it. So you went on strike. What did the university say and do in response to the strike?
Well, before we even went on strike, when we were threatening a strike in the first place in early April, the university across the board raised salaries for graduate workers to $18,000. Where salaries fell below that. And as I noted before, that's still $15,000 under the standard of living calculation for the city of Bloomington. But the university felt the need, some say coincidentally, some say otherwise, to raise salaries for graduate workers just pending a strike. And, of course, this fell significantly short of the demands that we were making of the university. Primary among them is union recognition. And so days later, we conducted our strike, voted to authorize the strike, and engaged in 4 weeks of striking through the month of April on into May. The university responded in a number of ways. Most alarmingly, the provost here in Bloomington threatened on multiple occasions to fire graduate workers and had told deans and chairs of various departments that they should prepare for graduate workers en masse to be fired in short time. We had various emails sent out to both faculty, graduate students, and undergraduate students individually, making a range of threats, either positioning, if it's faculty positioning, vis-a-vis the strike, in terms of neutrality. The provost would explicitly say that this is an inappropriate gesture from faculty. If graduate students were engaged in a work stoppage, they threatened what they call non-reappointment of student academic appointees, which is essentially being fired from your position.
Yeah.
So we've gotten the whole gamut of responses, both carrot and stick at this point.
Well, they're playing hardball, and that's, you know, pretty common. Quickly here, before we wrap up, what's the next step here, Cole? What do you got to do?
So through the summer, we have some exciting news. We're chartering a local here with United Electrical Workers in Bloomington, and we're going to be writing our bylaws, writing a constitution, setting that whole thing up, and ultimately, and I think most excitingly, preparing for re-engagement with the strike in the fall, hoping to begin the semester either with a strike or with a strike pending, so that we can use our time through the summer to get even more strong, to grow community support around IU, and by the end of this thing, win a union here.
There you go. Well, it sounds like you got some good people behind you, especially the United Electrical Workers there. And obviously, you got a friend here in America's workforce. So keep in touch with us. Hopefully, this podcast will help you out. I want to drive people to your website, and that's IndianaGradWorkers.org, IndianaGradWorkers.org. Cole, you stay in touch with us, okay?
Absolutely. Thanks for reaching out. I'm checking out that new website now.
And that website would be awfpodcast.com, awfpodcast.com. Cole Nelson joining us on our live line. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, the latest from the Ohio Federation of Teachers, and we're going to tell you about the American Edge Project dealing with the Intel facility in the state of Ohio. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening, and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.